Those of the staff, management, or ownership of WGCH Radio.
Welcome to A View of World Affairs from Greenwich. Politics, economy, history. A careful examination of the world's interrelationships and how they affect us, here in our country as well as here in Greenwich. And now here is your host, Fotis Baliakas.
Good morning, Greenwich. This is Fotis Baliakas coming to you from AM 1490 WGCH in Greenwich. Hope you're all doing well. Nice and chilly morning, but nice bright sun. Good sailing weather. This is my sixth radio broadcast, coming to you regularly now, Saturday mornings at 0900. Do you know what the O stands for? Oh my God, it's too early. So get your coffee, your notebook, and be ready for some food for thought. Today's subject is intelligence and foreign policy. To remind you, intel is a statecraft tool for conducting and projecting foreign policy, like diplomacy, military, economy, energy, religion, culture. So foreign policy is exercised by small and large countries. 2,500 years ago, Thucydides said, and I repeat that every time so that I can remind you how the world works, he laid down the law of geopolitics and life generally. The strong do what they can, while the weak struggle as they must. This is the reality that explains the great powers that exert their will on the world, and often without consequences, and why the victims are so often stuck with the consequences. So the strong do what they are allowed to, and the weak accept what they accepted, and they forgive them. So what we're going to talk about today is the intelligence and its effect on foreign policy. We're going to start back from the Revolutionary War here in the United States, move on to World War One, the intermittent years before World War II, which was the dramatic change in our policy. And then World War II starts the Cold War, and then all the way to the 21st century. So we will have quite a trip across the changes that have happened. But let me first, and I started that last time, I'm going to make a couple of points on the current situations that we have. Last Saturday, I mentioned about the tanks that we're giving to Kiev, what is happening there, you know, some of the latest, and my personal opinion. So we're coming up in the first anniversary of the war, and the conflict, as we can see, is nowhere to a near end, to an obvious end. The Ukrainians have scored tactical and strategic victories in repelling the initial attack, avoiding decapitation of their government, and then they captured lost territory in the east and south. The Russians have suffered humiliating tactical and strategic setbacks. Their initial thrust was repelled. They have no air superiority, no naval superiority, and furthermore, the loss of their flagship. They have now limited offensive capabilities, and they have mobilized additional, mostly untrained troops. So, in my view, what we call in this situation, the escalation advantage. Who can make the next move in a bigger way? I think the escalation advantage has shifted to Ukraine. That is my opinion. The mostly static war has now, in 45 trenches, it's very costly to overrun those trenches. And that reminds us what happened in World War One. Russians are using their tactics of throwing high concentration of heavy firepower and manpower, and both are not sustainable. We can see that the manpower that they are losing needs to be replenished, and that was the mobilization that they did. And also their firepower, we see now from reports that they have slowed down some of the high rate of firing that they had in heavy weapons so that they can conserve it and concentrate it where they must. So Karl von Clausewitz, a Prussian military strategist, spoke of total and limited war in his collections of the notes summarizing his book called On War. So war efforts are sustained and supported by the people behind the lines to supply manpower and the material for the war. Russia's war is limited. I'm not sure for how long. If you estimate the 200,000 dead and wounded, that's a huge amount, and it's climbing, and will definitely affect the Russian people and the Russian economy, in addition to everything else that we have thrown against them. The Ukrainians are fighting a total war, and that's their sacrifice to keep their land, their freedom, their country. It's an unshakable morale booster, and the society is wholeheartedly behind the effort and will sustain casualties and hardship for as long as they must. Remember what Thucydides said. So the result of this similar situation in World War I stalemate at fixed lines and trenches resulted in the invention of the tank. Similar situation happens here now in the east and south of Ukraine. My inclination is something different needs to happen. So I'm looking at a general idea is a split of east and south by driving a wedge through the middle of the occupied area in Ukraine to cut off the land bridge to Crimea. Crimea is after the bridge was, the newer Russian bridge was bombed and now is still being repaired. The land bridge, meaning the land they connected after Mariupol, is providing all the supplies to Crimea and also some of the by sea, but not as much. So that is where the tanks can play the role. That is where they come into play. They will offer the firepower, the protection, and the speed to amass the temporary numerical advantage to drive the wedge. The British Challengers, the German Leopards, and the French Leclercs can offer the platform immediately available, while the American M1A1 Abrams will be ideal for this situation because it is a tested weapon. But if it has a very high tooth-to-tail ratio. That is, the amount of actual frontline effort versus its logistic and ecological support behind the lines is very high. It has a lot of support that they need, a lot of personnel, different fuel. So, and it's an expensive weapon. Admiral Stavridis, who was the former U.S. Supreme NATO commander, said that about 200 of these tanks, or the collection of these tanks, can make the difference. I will add that we need the A-10 Warthogs for tactical ground support, and they can prove deadly again as they did in 1991 war in the Highway of Death. So in my opinion, once this split happens and it's underway, it changes the environment, it changes the war. The East now becomes a fight for the attrition in Crimea, for the isolation of the Russian troops there and the naval power, where the Ukrainian attack every effort to reinforce all of these supplies to Crimea. The East then will have another front leading from the South. Next week, we'll talk about what the Russians can do to escalate in their from their perspective. And everybody's talking about the tactical nuclear weapons, if they use it or not. I don't believe so, and I will state my case back then or in the future. Anyway, now we're coming back to what is intelligence and how it comes in to the foreign policy. So the mission of the intelligence community, called the IC, is to seek to reduce the uncertainty surrounding foreign activities, capabilities, or the foreign leader's intentions. This objective is very difficult to achieve when it's we're seeking to understand complex issues, foreign actors, politics, and we go to extraordinary lengths, and they do, to hide and obfuscate their activities. So it's very difficult, A, to capture the information, and B, to make sense of it. And that is where is the trick in the intelligence. So and we had many of them. The major national security controversies of the last decade, for example, have revolved around intelligence issues. September 11th, Iraq mass weapons the WMDs, the Iran's nuclear program. Many critics blame U.S. intelligence agencies for failing to prevent 9/11. Same thing that happened to Pearl Harbor. And then missed the mark on the Iraqi WMDs, the capabilities, before the 2003 war. So Congress has oversight over the intelligence agencies, which we all know as CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, but it's one of the 18 agencies right now, and there's a proposal for another one that takes care of the open source information. So open source is everything that you and I can read without any security clearance, and we can find it everywhere, from satellite pictures to reading the newspaper Pravda in Moscow. So everybody can read it. You have access. If you have enough money, you can subscribe to many. So there are many intelligence collection methods. There's an analysis process that takes that information, and the intelligence community has a relationship with the policymakers and with Congress that will read that information, understand it, and produce policy. So there are a lot of factors in between collection to making a decision by policymakers, and that is the very soft art nature of intelligence. And Alan Breakspear, I had written in the past, that says too much is made of secrecy and of covert operations and counterintelligence. Intelligence is often focused on threats, missing opportunities for advantage. Intelligence is a corporate capability to forecast change in time and do something about it. The capability involves foresight and insight and is intended to identify impeding changes, which may be positive, representing opportunity, or negative, representing threat. So let's, instead of theoretically talking about all of these issues about intelligence, let's go to some typical examples of intelligence. Our first intelligence officer was our first president and our general, George Washington. He actually employed intelligence, and he awarded the people who were involved in the intelligence. In 1775, Captain Nathan Hale was hung by the British. 11 days earlier, he had volunteered to enter Manhattan to gain information on the British army. In 1787, General Washington awarded Sergeant Daniel Bissell a medal because he faked the desertion and served 13 months in the British army to gather intelligence. So that is helping us to understand our enemy. That's basically where the intelligence comes in and is used by the leaders to act accordingly. Another example will be how in the Navy, actually the Navy had its own intelligence way before it was organized after World War II, and it was called the Office of the Naval Intelligence. So the naval intelligence started to understand the power and the capabilities of other nations and other navies. Their major contribution or failure to contribute, it was during the First World War, where after the Spanish-American-Filipino conflicts in 1898 to 1901, they missed the opportunity to identify that the German submarines, the U-boats, threatened to sink American ships on a regular basis, and they had no effective defense or deterrent against it. So that was a major miss that jeopardized men, material, and the entire war, which we will see later in World War II. So those are two examples that bring actual knowledge into conflict. Let's move on a little bit to more things happened in the space of intelligence. The President Roosevelt, FDR, had put together a group called the Office of Strategic Services in World War II to deal with intelligence information. Army intelligence at that time was obviously working on land. But what has happened in World War II at the beginning that brought us into the war, it was Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor. That was a big example of a failure. Now, what was it a failure? It was because not that we missed the signals from Japan that they are belligerent, but the Navy had installed officers 15 to 20 years prior into Tokyo as attachés, as military naval attachés, to understand the culture, to understand the nature of the people, and to see the up-and-coming cultural changes and differences because the Japanese were now being militarized and some of their naval officers were becoming very extreme. So they recognized that there were some positions that could drive the Japanese to that result, to attack. Did they expect it there? Did they expect it at that time? Did they expect it by airplanes? No, but Washington definitely had the information to prepare itself, and it was preparing, but it just didn't know when and where. So something that we'll repeat further down in 9/11 is they missed to connect the dots again. So that was the first time the Congress back then, in the 50s actually, after the war, did an investigation to see how the Pearl Harbor attack was missed, what has happened. And basically, it turned out to be that we did have the information, but we didn't have an established way of analyzing this data and making it so understandable and readable to the president and to the military leaders to understand the capability and the intention, and probably pinpoint time and place. But we corrected that. Naval officers in a small group in Hawaii pinpointed that the Japanese were preparing an attack to the islands of Midway. And after they convinced the military brass that attack was imminent, Nimitz sent four carriers there and defeated and sunk the Japanese carriers. And that was the beginning of the end to the Japanese campaign and the war. That was huge. That intelligence information and that small group made a huge change to the war. And everything else followed. Now, another example of World War II intelligence, which made, again, a very big impact on the war, is that Stalin, and generally speaking, the Russians prefer human intelligence. They had a mall in Tokyo. So Stalin was not sure, Uncle Joe, was not sure if Japan will attack on the Pacific side, so he had a major concentration of his armies in the east. But also he was afraid that after he signed the pact with Stalin, with Hitler, he would have to commit back because they were very good frenemies. So he couldn't commit both. And as we know, the French had helped him to build the Trans-Siberian Railroad, and that was his way of transferring power or his troops from one coast to the other, or from one front to the other. So when the Japanese or their contact within the Japanese government confirmed that they were not be attacked by Japan and they will attack the United States, he shifted nearly all of his powers, all of his military power, from that front and brought them to face the Germans. Huge difference. Otherwise, Germany wouldn't have any issues going beyond the Urals, beyond their mountains. So that was a major win for Uncle Joe. Now, moving into the war, the Allies were able to break the communication code from the Germans called Enigma. It's a Greek word again, so allow me, being Greek, to tell you that it's puzzle. It's called puzzle, Enigma. So when we broke that by taking one of their devices, very complicated devices, some Polish scientists were involved, obviously British and some Americans, broke the code. We broke the code in such a way that they didn't know, and they continued to use it. So here it is, something that we broke the code. We could have made all the changes and avoid many deaths and a lot of material losses, but the Churchill administration continue not to acknowledge that, and no one did. And eventually we trapped some of their submarines and their way of operation because we knew where they would be, and the convoys were able to avoid them. So the code, the break of the code was a major, major change in the war that helped us to overcome their military operations. Now, another one would be, as I mentioned in my last week, I mentioned that FDR made the approach in the 30s to Russia in order to split the Axis power, the Axis powers, from Germany and Italy to Japan, have Russia in the middle and split the two, and then Russia gets involved. Now we have them surrounded, so to speak. So as the Russians were defending the incoming German armies into their land, into Russia, Stalin was asking for the Allies to start a new front to take the pressure off him. And the new front started in Africa. And then from Africa moved to Italy and eventually moved to France in the Normandy in the Operation Overlord. But before the Operation Overlord happened, there was another operation called Operation Mincemeat. It was a diversion. It was a setup so that the Germans would think otherwise and the Allies will make the landing on June 6th, 1944, in the Normandy area. It was major, major setup so that the information will be directing them to a totally different strategic direction of the Allies where the operation, the actual operation, happened under their noses. So the intelligence in that instant was tremendously useful to the Allies, and it was used to send them in the wrong direction. Now, moving on from there, as we know, after 1945, Germany split, and we've sensed the Cold War is coming. And obviously the Americans were preparing the Manhattan Project, which is the development of our nuclear weapons. And that was in the heart of America. But we had the first two bombs ready in 1945. We used them in Nagasaki and Hiroshima. And then we had some leftovers for additional bombs, but they weren't made. But what happened in 1949, we were surprised that the Russians had made their own weapon. Well, they couldn't have made their own weapon because they were lacking all of that experience that we had. They had scientists within the group at the Manhattan Project that stole that information. So all of that intelligence ran through there, and the technology was taken away. Now, what happened in 1947 is critical to intelligence and the intelligence community. There was the National Security Act of 1947. Congress passed the act that created CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency, and by the way, and the Air Force as well. So it was President Truman that did that. And I have written a little paper. He says, what were President Harry Truman's major positive and negative contributions to the development of the modern intelligence community? So President Truman was instrumental in establishing the IC as we know today. He realized the value of an informal foreign policy of an informed foreign policy as the U.S. was slipping into a new global role. But he was also was looking at domestic politics, and he wanted to create a community where the collection and the operation of professionals will come in to collect and understand the data. The Japanese attack at Pearl Harbor is a classic case of intelligence failure, and they wanted to avoid that. So the president and the foreign policy apparatus back then were not served by a dedicated intelligence system. FDR, as a first reaction to the strategic surprise by the Japanese, appointed Bill Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan, who was his nickname, as the coordinator and later founded the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services. And that was mostly human intelligence activities organized under the chain of command of the newly created, back in 1942, the Joint Chief of Staff at the Department of War. Prior to the Department of War, which was the Defense Department now, the Navy had its own department and it had its own intelligence branch, and those were all collected together. So during the war, the U.S. in cooperation with the British were masterful in signals intelligence, and they were able to break the Japanese code, which was called MAGIC, and the German code, which was called ULTRA, and the Russian code, which was called VERONA. So this wartime experience proved the strategic importance of intelligence. President Truman inherited the establishment, which grew haphazardly during the war and no longer served the peacetime with nuclear weapons and a Cold War coming up. So in 1945, he disbanded OSS, looking for a more centralized and robust organization when the Cold War with the Soviet Union was taking shape, and it became clear that there was an acute need to coordinate the intelligence being produced. Attempting to solve the military unification issue, which, as I mentioned, the different departments were separated, retained the OSS capabilities under the Central Intelligence Organization, and the president in 1946, via the National Intelligence Directive No. 5, created the Central Intelligence Group for strategic analysis and clandestine activities. But despite its broad scope of authority under the director and oversight by the National Intelligence Authority, a committee comprising the Secretaries of State, War, Navy, and the President and his military advisors did not explicitly force the consolidation of a preeminent foreign intelligence arm of the U.S. government under one command. So the CIA is created at that point, and consolidation of different departments into one so that we can streamline this. Now, you will see this conversation again when we come into 9/11. It is a almost an organizational management, because we can get the information, but we need to get it to the right people and to be of the right content to be understood. Because sometimes even the intelligence analyst writing about and understanding what the information comes to them, they have to comprehend it. They have to put it in such a way that gives it a grade, gives it a color, gives it a direction, so that, but it does not give them an opinion. does not give them an opinion for policy. The policymakers read that, and then they make policy against it. So that is what happened with the creation of the 1947 Act. Moving on to the Cold War. So 1949, we're surprised. Nuclear weapons by the USSR. They test them first. Now they give us a bell. Boom. We know they have it. Huge difference. How did they get it? We know exactly how they got it. It was all leaked from inside the U.S. Now, 1950 to 1953, another failure in intelligence. Korean War erupts. North Korea attacks South Korea. We were just about ready to dismantle our military and move on. That happens in 1950. Furthermore, China gets involved, and we got caught flat-footed. We didn't know China's going to get involved because it was on their border. So the intelligence failed twice. The good thing about the Korean War, though, was a bell, a red flag that went up, so that in the other side of the world, in the European theater, we had already started the creation of NATO. And now NATO started to form because we just didn't want to be flat-footed again in another theater, i.e. in Europe, that was an active field of competition with the Russians. 1957, big year. The Russians send Sputnik, our first man-made satellite, out and about, orbiting the Earth and pinging us all the time. We were flabbergasted. Where did this come from? We missed it. Another failure. We missed it. That's technology. We missed the takeoff. We missed how they got there. So obviously, they had the know-how, and they put it up in orbit. So we're working towards it, and later on, obviously, we went to the moon first, but it was a wake-up call. It was a loss. It was a miss. Some of the operations back then, some of the operations by CIA and their cohort organizations had to do with a lot of covert operations. And by that, I mean their influence in foreign countries, their influence in their political status of another country. If we didn't like, or our allies didn't like, the government of a certain country, we will interfere. And that was part to the Truman Doctrine, that we didn't want the Cold War expanded and reach our shores. We want to keep it as far out as possible. So in cases like Iran is a good example. In 1953, there was a democratically elected government by Mossadegh, and at that time the British were in the Middle East following the end of the war, and 40% of the Western and about 75% of Europe's oil was produced in Iran. And Britain was very resentful of that nationalization by the Iranian oil industry. And in the 1950s, they started to stir up the pot there. We were not involved, but somewhere in that time frame, the British came to us and asked us for our help to intervene with the Iranians. And the Iranians gave us an ultimatum that said that we will give you, if you don't change the government and you give us 50% of the oil rights, we will give you a discounted oil price and we will all live together. Well, that was rejected by the U.S., by the Truman administration, and later the Eisenhower administration went into with a British position where that should not happen, and we should intervene to depose the democratically elected government. So our bad history with Iran starts at that point where, in a coup, we helped the British depose Mohammad Mossadegh and install what would become the Shah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, who was deposed in 1979 by the Islamists and who are still in power. And that history still remains. So we were involved in some cases like this where it didn't really go well. The National Security Agency was developed in 1952 to start managing a lot of that information, because now we have signals intelligence. We have a lot of signals. We have listening posts around the world. We're listening who is communicating with who. Obviously, we want our enemies to we find their information. So we have electronics intelligence, we have communications intelligence, we have instrumentation intelligence. So we want to know when and who is going to fire a missile, what signals they will emit. So we know next time if we hear or see that signal, that means something. That means that they're preparing for something. They are firing up a missile that may be an ICBM or otherwise. So now all of these technology groups under the NSA started to come into play, and the community is growing. So now we have the National Defense Agency combined with the military agencies that make a lot of the information and then the analysis that come with it. So as we're developing these, and we had Sputnik out there, now we started a program that we started to put satellites up there of our own, because we want to see what is happening around the world. We have the technology now. We're ahead of the Russians. We put a lot more satellites that we have. So we have a secret program back then called Corona. So the Corona, it was a... started in 1962, very secret, expensive technology, lifted off the Air Force bases around the U.S., and we put satellites up in orbit. So we will, you know, roam around the world in different rotations and different satellites, and we will take pictures of the world. And then we will rely on those to make policy decisions, such as, are the Russians ahead of us in the amount of missiles that they have? Are there Russians ahead of us in the bases that they have or in the troops concentrations? Where are they? And then we will act accordingly. So our budget will go up and down depending on what they found, and Congress will say, well, you know, we found 50 new silos that they have in Siberia. We didn't know that they were there. That means that they will deploy weapons from there. Let's do the same thing. So this race, this weapons and arms race started. So the budgets are now flowing in order to do that. So you see how this intelligence information translated to policy, translated to economy, translated to budgets. So they're all interconnected. What we did miss, though, and that was one of the key issues that came to a point, is the Cuban Missile Crisis. So although Corona went up, it went over the Cuba many times. We missed intelligence about what was happening in Cuba. We missed the ship transfers from Russia to Cuba carrying the missiles. We missed intelligence reports that said Cubans were involved with Russians deploying the weapons. And we were nowhere to be found as far as reacting to it, until we had some overflights after we were suspicious. We did some overflights with U-2 airplanes. The U-2 and the SR-71 are two reconnaissance airplanes, high altitude. And actually, the U-2 was involved in watching this latest balloon from China that was downed in South Carolina a couple of weeks ago. And this balloon was at 6,000 feet, and that's about 70,000 feet being the level of a U-2 can fly over. And the SR-71, it's a three times plus the speed of sound traveling around the world for the purpose, no weapons on board other than cameras. We take pictures. As a matter of fact, a U-2 can go over an entire country in one pass in 8 hours and photograph every single piece of land that they can find. And they can go through clouds. They can go through rain. We have the technology. And then they will bring back the film, and then they will analyze it and compare it with the day before. So they will see if there was any activity. Well, that was missed in 1962. In Cuba, and that created, obviously, a big, big issue. So moving on from there, obviously, we know how we resolved. We spoke about it last week. But if we had that information way before it was developed, way before they were transferred, way before they were prepared, installed, and ready to be fired, we would have been in a totally different position than President Kennedy found himself and his executive committee in those 13 days in 1962. So intel. One other great success, I will say, technology, because the CIA group or the intelligence community group, they involved not only human and spatial assets, but any kind of technology that we can create. And there was a project codenamed Azorian. It was in 1971, the Russians lost in the 60s. They lost a submarine in 1968. They lost a submarine, a Kilo-2 class submarine, codenamed K-129, and it went out missing in the Pacific. We had the technology and know-how to find it because we found our own submarine, the one that we had lost in the Atlantic on its way back from a deployment, and we found it. It was under almost 16,000 feet of water, and we knew exactly where it was. But then, how do we get it? So this great success story, which ultimately is questionable if it's successful or not, but we made a ship, a 600-foot ship. Under the Hughes, the strange billionaire back then, made a ship that was actually made for CIA. It looked like a derrick, big ship that will drill down the bottoms of the ocean. It was for offshore drilling, very deep offshore drilling, and that ship actually went in, found under the eyes of Russians, found the submarine, picked it up, and unfortunately, at least half of it fell off the claw that was lifting it up. But we were looking for clues, even how they weld their steel, what technology they use for the missiles, what technology they use for propulsion, what technology they use to silence their submarines. That's what they were looking for, so that we can make our lives easier. We can follow them so that they don't know we're there. And we were looking for the advantage. That advantage translated to security for us, translated to not being so excited about their technology. That was lacking. It was behind us. But we just didn't have enough information, so we were building up a case. So, you know, you give a general an idea that somebody else has another weapon. In his eyes, it's much bigger than ours. Let's make it three times as big. So that escalation could be checked with accurate information. So this was one of the, it's called the Glomar Explorer. That was a great success story by the CIA back then. Moving on to latest developments, the 9/11 story again failed to connect the dots because we had the information. We knew the people. We knew that they were traveling. We just didn't speak the same language between the agencies, left and right. So we left them. We left ourselves exposed because by law and by some legal constraints, the CIA could not speak to the FBI. The FBI has full access to the domestic land. CIA has none. So we couldn't get together, and that's what slammed us. So big, big miss Big miss from that one. Other issues that came in following that, it was another black eye for the intelligence community. That was the 2003 misunderstanding about the weapons of mass destruction. We made a presentation to the UN having some information. That information turned out to be not made, but it was misconstrued. It was misanalyzed. So it's another example that that information could be politicized, maybe, and it would be used to start something as a war in 2003 that cost us lives and treasure. So the right information may have caused us not to be there and not to create such destruction, upheaval, loss of life, etc. So giving the presidents the right information is critical. So I'm going to read from another paper that I wrote that is what are the most important challenges to effective intelligence analysis? The intelligence analysis is the primary process where the IC community supports the civilian and military policy decision makers with the knowledge to make well-informed decisions. Intelligence and analysis exist to avoid the strategic failures we faced when we became ignorant of the intentions of foreign countries, such as Pearl Harbor, North Korea, China, Cuban Missile Crisis, Iranian Revolution, collapse of the USSR, and the 9/11 terrorist attack. So we want to concentrate on not making the same mistake. We want to improve. So the generation, proliferation, and management of the process rests on the professionals that study and produce the intellectual product, which policymakers, which are the consumers, use to make hugely important decisions. The president reads intelligence every morning, read to him by an assigned officer of the DNI, and there are different ways that the presidents absorb that information. And I wrote a paper which different presidents read it differently. So there's a definitive correlation. This is from my paper. Definitive correlation between successful foreign policy applied by a president and the intelligence information provided to him over strategic issues. Herein, in the paper, a thesis is developed where successful intelligence is defined by the correct requirements, meaning ask the right questions. Then we can get answers. Followed by collection from all possible intelligence sources with human and technical open and classified sources. When this data is analyzed and produced, it leads to successful outcomes in foreign policy. Intelligence has been used in various degrees and forms from our first president to the 45th. And now the 46th. There are numerous examples of failed policies with a common theme of faulty or no intelligence to guide the president and its advisors to beneficial application in U.S. foreign policies. And in many cases, these failures resulted in military conflict with catastrophic results. Events like Pearl Harbor, surprise attack, the Korean conflict, and the Chinese intervention, and the 2003 invasion of Iraq are prime examples where the president either reacted to something avoidable because he received no tactical or strategic warning, the analysts or senior policymakers did not trust the information, or the intelligence was faulty that led them to bad decisions. There are also success stories like the Cuban Missile Crisis, where despite an initial intelligence failure, there was a recovery that helped President Kennedy to negotiate a mutually beneficial agreement with the Soviets and avert a nuclear war with unfathomable consequences. There are also other examples where the idiosyncrasies of the president or his senior advisors and the secrecy of actions with the adversaries did not allow for the full development of intelligence that would have helped the U.S. to take full benefit of its interactions, thus missed opportunities to optimize a U.S. foreign policy. How great or greater would have the U.S. be today if these failures have not happened? So I went through several presidents, but I will skip the individuals, go to the conclusion, and I will read from there. Scrolling. Okay, here we go. The intelligence information used by our past presidents to make strategic, geopolitical, economic, and military decisions has not been consistent. With a major variable, the personality of our presidents, the intelligence available at the time was used to varying degrees of success and failure. Among our successes, we counted the 1962 Cuban crisis that ended with the removal of the nuclear weapons from Cuba, no nuclear exchange between superpowers, no unilateral military action by the U.S., and a detente with Cuba until recently when we reopened the diplomatic mission. The event was successful because despite our original estimate of no missiles in Cuba, the IC produced professional product that the president used for the best outcome possible. Our collective INT, intelligence, capability was at the disposal of the senior policymakers. Another spectacular failure, as I mentioned, was the Iraqi invasion. Other cases count as missed opportunities to shape a better U.S. foreign policy conducted by president or a small circle of confidence in a secretive way with limited or questionable intelligence about the adversary or the enemy. These cases have a very long-term effect, as we have witnessed from the collapse of the Soviet Union in December of 1990. We did not foresee it. CIA did not foresee it. The opening to China in 1972, it was done in so secret way for political, domestic political purposes from Nixon and Kissinger, that he did not allow for the full vetting of that information and why we did it and how we did it and when do we do it. And also the back then with FDR, the normalization of relations with the Soviets in 1933, was that something that helped us in the long term? Or the Munich Agreement in 1938 where we appeased Hitler? Coming to one of the latest examples of intelligence or lack thereof, we look at the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So that security dilemma, where we see that the opposite or neighbor or the other side has the capacity to affect the change, which is the product of intention and capability. Those are two things, intention and capability. So, did the Russians have an intention? Absolutely. But they also have the capability. And we missed their capability in their hollow army. We overrated them way, way too much. And that caused us to send an Uber to pick up Zelensky out where we should have been sending him ammunition and weapons to fight. And we missed the opportunity up front and still to this day to arm them properly, to end the war and stop the aggression, the Russian aggression. And that can happen in the same example in China versus Taiwan. This is all for today. Thank you for listening. This is Fotis Poliakis. I'm also the managing partner for Hellenic Aluminum Company of America. And we wish you a great weekend.
This is your community radio station, serving Lower Fairfield County and Westchester, 1490 WGCH in Greenwich.